This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research. Were it not for scuba diving, Vicki Chandler might never have become a scientist. She was a secretary and single mother of two when she took up the hobby and became fascinated by the complex world of plants and animals she saw underwater. Inspired to study marine biology, she enrolled in a junior college and took her first biology class, where she discovered a passion for genes that sealed her fate. She stopped diving and became a geneticist instead. Chandler is the Chief Program Officer of Science for the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. She was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2002. Dr. Chandler was interviewed by Gisela Tellis in 2008.
My name's Vicki Chandler. My field is gene regulation, genetics, epigenetics. I was elected to the Academy in 2002.
Tell me about your parents and what they did and where you grew up.
Well, my father was in the military. He was a sergeant in the military in the Air Force. So when I was really small and he was on active duty, I lived in a lot of places because military families tend to move around. My father retired when I was 9 years old to Northern California. So that's really where I was raised. Neither of my parents went to college. So I was a first-generation college student. My sister and I were both first-generation college students. As soon as I can remember going to school, I remember the expectations were very high that for both my sister and I that we were going to do very well in school. We were going to go to college. But there wasn't a lot of pressure to be a certain kind of career or follow a certain path. They were pretty supportive.
Where do you think that sort of determination that you would go to college came from?
I think it came from my parents growing up in hardworking Midwest families and their belief that education was really important to a productive lifestyle, in spite of the fact that because of World War II and other things that came to be, they ended up not getting a college education. They believed in it.
How did you first become interested in science?
Well, I didn't quite follow the traditional path. I became interested in science because of a hobby. I got very intrigued by and excited by scuba diving, and this was on the Northern California, and was fascinated by all of the creatures in the ocean. And at that time, had decided that I had not gone to college, which my parents had wanted me to do, because I had gotten married and had children very young. But at that point, I was divorced, and I was thinking, gee, it'd be great. I really should go to college. And hadn't, because I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. But then once I got hooked on scuba diving, I thought, oh, I'll be a marine biologist. So because I didn't have any money, I went to a junior college in Northern California in Los Altos Hills. It's called Foothills Junior College. And when I went and talked to the counselor said, well, you know, you're going to have to take math, you're going to have to take chemistry and physics and biology and all of these courses. And I said, okay, fine, I'll start taking them. Someone had told me chemistry was the hardest. I actually don't agree. But so I took a chemistry class and loved it. And then I took my first biology class and loved it. But I got hooked on genes in that first biology class in genetics and never looked back, stopped scuba diving, and ended up becoming a geneticist, biochemist, not a marine biologist.
So you're going to have to go back and tell me about not going to college after all of that pressure, too.
Well, I was a little bit of a, I really wasn't a rebel, but I was very pretty independent. And I ended up getting married at a young age. I was still in high school, had a child.
How old?
I was 17. And it really wasn't possible to go to college at that time. I needed to work. I needed to help take care of the kids. I got divorced at 19 with two children. It wasn't possible to go to college. At least I didn't think it was. I had to care for my daughters. But
what did you do?
I worked as a secretary. And I ended up moving to Palo Alto, which is near Foothills Junior College, and my kids were put into a particular daycare center. And I met a number of other women, all of which were similar ages, had kids. And I'm not quite sure, it was just sort of a magic time, I guess. This was in the mid-1970s. We all figured out we could go to college. And we all helped each other and started back to college, or started college in my case. And there's five or six of us that have all managed to be quite successful in our chosen careers. So it was a really remarkable time to figure out that you could do it in spite of a lot of strikes against you.
So then you were working and going to college, and you went to this junior college first, and then what happened?
Well, I started at the junior college, and I did very well. I got very good grades there. Like I said, I loved it. I was in my mid-20s at that point, and I was doing something because I wanted to, and I wasn't dumb, so I managed to do well in classes. And I was working student aid, helping set up the labs. And at that time, one of the biology teacher at Foothill was connected. I'm not quite sure how he knew folks at Stanford, which was right next door. And he used to have students, graduate students from Stanford, come over and talk about the latest things happening in their research. And I remember hearing a number of just incredible talks by a couple of these graduate students. And so I started on a little research project at the junior college and really got the bug. Ended up getting a full scholarship to Berkeley. After I transferred to Berkeley, I got quite good help from the Alumni Association. And back in those days, I think it was $200 a quarter for tuition at Berkeley, an amazingly good deal. Of course, that was a lot of money to me, but I got great scholarships and financial aid and managed to go to school. I had learned from a friend of mine at Stanford that a man named Randy Scheckman had just started as an assistant professor at Berkeley, and so I went and knocked on his door the first month I was on the campus. I was now a junior. And Randy let me start working in his lab. And that was great. He was a wonderful person to learn to do science from. And he was encouraging in spite of the fact that I was an older female student with two young children. And he encouraged me to go for it.
How did you manage that?
Well, we didn't have a whole lot of money. We lived in married student housing. My kids went to school, you know, public schools. I rode the bus. And my parents helped. They didn't really support me financially, but they made sure the kids had clothes and, you know, things. So they were supportive in that sense and lived only about 50 miles away. So that was helpful. And, you know, just a combination of different ways of making ends meet.
Did you work in addition to working in the lab?
I did. I tended to do work study. The way the system worked then in California is if I worked, originally I worked half-time at a regular job and then went to school, and I didn't make a lot of money, but I made too much money to qualify for like Medicare for the kids. And so there was a balance. At some point it was actually better to be even more destitute. But, you know, it really wasn't hard times. It was very exciting times because it was so much better than working as a secretary. You know, I'd meet friends in classes, and I was excited and stimulated, and the kids had a great experience at the married student housing because most of the people that lived there were from all kinds of different countries. So they grew up, you know, at that age, they really met people from a large number of different cultures, and I just think it was a wonderful way for them to experience the world without having to go anywhere. So that was great. I met my current husband. We've now been married 30 years, my senior year at Berkeley. And we ended up getting married about a year later. And he had two sons the same age as my two daughters, so we ended up raising the four kids ourselves. But no question, four with two parents is a whole lot easier than being a single parent with two.
So you started working in the lab, and how was that?
Oh, I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
What were you working on then?
So at that time, Randy had just, it was the first year he was setting up his lab, and he gave me a project to look at. He was working with yeast cells, and his idea was to set up the system that he's now famous for, which was to study protein trafficking in cells. And there was literature that showed that the component of the yeast cell wall was trafficking, the proteins that synthesized it was trafficking. So my project was to use a compound that stained this chitin and to look at how it was deposited in growing yeast cells and when they divided. And so anyway, that was my first project. And ended up getting a PNAS paper with Randy and myself. Of course, he did the bulk of the intellectual. I was the hands, but so I was just an undergraduate. But it was a really wonderful, wonderful experience. And Randy encouraged me to apply for a summer program at Cold Spring Harbor Labs, which I did and got admitted to. And he also encouraged me to apply to graduate schools, which I did. And ended up going to graduate school at UCSF, University of California, San Francisco Medical School. As a graduate student, I worked with Keith Yamamoto on steroid hormone regulation of mouse mammary tumor virus. Mouse mammary tumor virus was a retrovirus which integrated into the host genome, and Keith's group had shown that the integrated virus, that template, was induced by glucocorticoids. So somehow the virus carried the information to respond to steroid hormone induction of transcription. And so at a time when, you know, cloning was just starting and a lot of the techniques that we take for granted now weren't there, it was a really good model system for looking at gene regulation in response to steroid hormones. And I had actually, as I mentioned, got very excited about biology because of genes and gene regulation, so I was really excited about working on this project with Keith.
And how did that lead to your work with plants?
Well, sort of serendipitously, I guess. I think of myself really as a geneticist that happens to work on plants. I'm really not a plant biologist, as you can tell from my training. And I was reading and trying to think about, so my thesis research was going well, and of course you need to be thinking about what are you going to do with the rest of your life. So I was starting to think about what I might want to do for a postdoc and what I might want to work on. And was reading the literature on transposons at the time. So this was in the early 80s, and retroviruses were shown to be related to retrotransposons, which were transposons that were in a lot of creatures. They were best studied at that time in Drosophila. So
can
I started
you sort of give a layman's definition of a transposon.
Well, a transposon is basically a piece of DNA that can move itself around the genome. And all creatures from bacteria to man have these sequences in them. And they come in different flavors and different categories and different sequences. Barbara McClintock, working with the corn plant, received the Nobel Prize in the 1980s for her discoveries of transposable elements from her work in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So there was a rich literature about these elements in corn, and they were also extremely well studied in Drosophila, the fruit fly. And then the other system that people were really working on a lot then was the yeast cell. So I was reading all this literature because I was fascinated about this type of regulation. And kind of through that avenue started reading the literature on corn, and then discovered this for myself in the literature, this process called paramutation, where one allele of a gene, one form of a gene, can communicate with another one and change it essentially forever. And I thought that was pretty fascinating, and just like transposons, probably pretty fundamental to genomes and how they work, and decided that that was something I wanted to try to work on. And since it was only described in corn, that was the reason I then went and did a postdoc in a corn lab and basically started the line of research that I continue today.
And you've continued your focus on the maize plant since then?
Yes.
And what have you discovered in that time?
What we've been able to do is begin to dissect the underlying mechanism of this process called paramutation, and use both a sort of classic genetics approach, but combining that with molecular biology, genomics, and biochemistry to dissect it. And what we've shown is that the process involves an RNA-mediated chromatin change.
Which means,
as you know, our genomes are made up of DNA, but a common product from that genome is RNA, which is copied from the DNA. And for many years, people thought RNA really came in only two flavors. There's RNA that is then the template to make proteins, which are the molecules that carry out bulk of the processes of the cell. Or there was RNA that formed structures like on the ribosome, or critical components of the cell. So there was structural RNA, there was informational RNA. It's now clear, not for my work, but others, that there's catalytic RNA, so RNA can actually be enzymes. And I would say over the last 15 or 20 years, people are recognizing that there's a lot of regulatory RNA. So people have known for a long time that a lot of our genome is turned into RNA, even when they couldn't figure out what it was there for. And that's still true. There's a lot of RNA made that nobody knows what that RNA is doing. Some of it may be, quote, junk, but others clearly has important roles in regulation. And a number of years ago now, in the late 1980s, early 90s, this process called RNAi was discovered. It was first shown in plants and then discovered by Andy Fire and Craig Mello and C. Elegans that got the Nobel Prize a year or so ago for their discoveries, which were phenomenal. And that process degrades RNA by this, RNAi stands for RNA interference. So these little small RNAs can break down other RNA. The process that I'm studying also involves similar enzymes, but it doesn't affect RNA levels. It affects whether the RNA is copied from the DNA or not. So it's a different process, but related. And what's fascinating, and we don't understand, so we know who a lot of the key players are now, but we don't understand how they all work. So that's what we're trying to sort out. But somehow, a particular piece of DNA makes RNA, and that can communicate with another copy and cause silencing of adjacent genes. And that silencing is inherited for multiple generations. But it doesn't involve any changes in DNA sequence. So there are very few processes in plants in terms of gene regulation that haven't also been found in animals. So my hypothesis is this is also going on, or something similar is going on in animals and humans. And so we're now working on both. We have a human cell project and mouse project as well as plant projects.
Clearly you've been juggling a lot of different things ever since you took on becoming a scientist. How have you balanced work and your life?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I think my husband would probably tell you I don't have a very balanced life right now. Because if someone asks him what my hobby is, he says my work. As a student and then an assistant professor, postdoc and assistant professor, always having children through that period of my life, I think you balance by just setting priorities and doing what you have to do. I always made sure that there were time for the kids. We had very specific rules. We all had to be home at a certain hour, including me. We had dinner every night, except they were off the hook Friday and Saturday nights when they got older, so that we could be with each other and share in each other's days. So I think you balance, and I think, frankly, my life was more balanced when my kids were younger and at home. Once they left home and it was me, my husband, and my dogs, I tended to work even more hours than I did with my kids at home. But I'm not a super person. I have a lot of energy and I enjoy what I do. But I also love my family, and I've got six grandkids now, and make sure that I see them regularly and are in their lives, because I think that's really important.
What are some of the major obstacles that you've encountered in trying to have a career in science?
I'm not sure obstacles is the right word. I don't want to sound Pollyanna, because I'm really not. But frankly, I think the biggest obstacle is not enough hours in the day to do everything that you put on your plate. I do think women still have to be better than a man to achieve at the same level in most fields. We're held at a different standard still. It's more unconscious bias. I don't think it's outwardly. I don't feel like I had huge obstacles put in front of me because I was a woman. Two of my three mentors were men, and they were incredibly supportive of me, treated me with a lot of respect, and gave me opportunities to really grow. So I feel very fortunate in that way. I try to do that now myself for younger folks coming up through the ranks, whether they're male or female. I really try to make sure people are given opportunities to show what they can accomplish.
What advice would you give to a young person interested in a career in science?
Follow your passion. Be excited about what you're doing. I think one thing that's really helped me all my life, especially, as you say, when you're juggling a lot of different things, is I just do it. I don't worry about it. I don't spend any time worrying about what I've got to do. I just start doing it and crossing it off the list. I have seen folks coming along that I've mentored over the years that waste a lot of energy worrying about what they need to do, and it's best just to do it. So I think that's important. I guess another piece of advice, especially for women, young women, is if you're given an opportunity, go for it, even if it feels very frightening and you're not sure you can do it, go for it. Do it. I think a key component of success is being on the edge and pushing yourself outside of comfort zones. And if you don't take advantage of those opportunities and push yourself out of your comfort zone, you won't get as far, in my guess.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.